I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Democracy Now!
Was it the assessment of the intelligence community that there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime, yes or no?
Senator, the only person who can determine what is and is not an imminent threat is the president.
False. This is the worldwide.
As the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, says President Trump alone made the assessment that Iran posed an imminent threat to the United States, the Mideast war appears to be escalating. Israel bombed Iran's South Pars gas field, the largest natural gas field in the world, prompting retaliatory strikes by Iran on energy infrastructure across the Gulf. Will Gulf countries be drawn into the war? We'll speak with Johns Hopkins professor Vali Nasser, who says Iran is playing a long game. And as oil tops $118 a barrel, we'll go to London to speak with Lawa Khalili, author of Extractive Capitalism, then to Washington, D.C., to talk to Congressmember Rokana about the War Powers Act.
And every day we're spending $2 billion of American money in Iran. To put that in perspective, for 20 days in Iran, we could have free public college for every American.
We'll also speak with Congressmember Khanna about why Democrats walked out of a surprise closed-door hearing with Attorney General Pam Bondi over the Epstein files. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S.-Israeli war in Iran entered a new phase Wednesday after Israel bombed Iran's South Pars gas field, the largest known natural gas reserve in the world. The attack set off huge fires at a refinery and petrochemical facility that process the majority of Iran's domestic supply of natural gas. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps retaliated by attacking energy infrastructure across the Persian Gulf. Within hours, Iranian missiles caused extensive damage to Qatar's Raslafin facility, which handles nearly 20% of global exports of liquefied natural gas. Separate attacks from Iran damaged two refineries in Kuwait, two oil fields in the United Arab Emirates, and a Saudi Aramco refinery at the port of Yanbu, a critical oil terminal in the Red Sea, far from Iran, on Saudi Arabia's western coast. The escalating attacks set off panic in global markets and sent the price of oil skyrocketing as high as $118 a barrel. Several governments in Asia are now rationing fuel, slashing public services, and shortening work weeks to conserve energy. Here in the U.S., gasoline prices are now at their highest level since 2023, are set to climb further. On Wednesday, Vice President J.D. Vance addressed soaring fuel prices after a meeting in Michigan with the American Petroleum Institute.
It's not going to last forever. We're going to take care of business. We're going to come back home. And when that happens, you're going to see energy prices come back down to reality. But in the meantime, we got a problem. We know that we have a problem. We're doing everything that we can to address it.
The Pentagon is seeking more than $200 billion in additional funding for the U.S.-Israeli war in Iran. That's according to The Washington Post, which reports the military seeking to urgently increase production of weapons expended in thousands of U.S. and Israeli strikes over the past 3 weeks. On Capitol Hill, Republican senators Wednesday blocked a vote on a war powers resolution to rein in President Trump's attacks on Iran. Meanwhile, Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard testified to the Senate Intelligence Committee that U.S.-Israeli attacks on Iran last June had obliterated Iran's nuclear program with no effort underway to rebuild it. Georgia Democratic Senator John Ossoff asked Gabbard whether that aligned with President Trump's claims that Iran posed an imminent threat to the United States.
Was it the intelligence community's assessment that, nevertheless, despite this obliteration, there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime? Yes or no?
It is not the intelligence community's responsibility to determine what is and is not an imminent threat.
Okay.
That is up to
here's,
the president
the problem.
Based on a volume
no, it
of
is,
information
it is precisely,
that he receives.
It is precisely your responsibility to determine what constitutes a threat to the United States. This is the worldwide threats hearing.
Outside the Capitol building, lawmakers joined anti-war activists at a memorial display of backpacks and children's shoes, commemorating the more than 200 children who've reportedly died in U.S.-Israeli strikes on Iran. This is Illinois Democratic Congressmember Delia Ramirez.
From Palestine to Iran, our bombs are killing women. They're killing children, little girls who are yearning to learn. And they're displacing thousands and thousands and thousands. Because from Cuba to Lebanon, our governments are violating U.S. and international law.
Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli attacks have killed 45 people across Lebanon over the past 2 days, with over 1 million people forcibly displaced by Israel's assault. The U.N. Children's Fund, that's UNICEF, says Israeli attacks are killing or wounding 30 children in Lebanon a day, the equivalent of an entire classroom. On Wednesday, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said his forces had destroyed two more bridges over Lebanon's Litani River, further cutting off southern Lebanon from the rest of the country. Meanwhile, Hezbollah fighters fired heavy barrages of rockets towards Israel. In the occupied West Bank, three Palestinians were killed and 13 others injured Wednesday night when parts of an intercepted Iranian missile fell on a hair salon near Hebron. The dead included two adults and a 17-year-old. Few Palestinians in the West Bank have access to fortified shelters, unlike in Israel, where bomb shelters are common. In Israel, an Iranian cluster munition ripped through the Tel Aviv suburb of Ramat Gan on Wednesday, killing an elderly couple in their home. Police said they failed to reach a fortified safe room in their apartment before it was struck. Elsewhere, a man described as a foreign worker was killed by a missile attack in Israel's Sharon area. Israel's health ministry reported 177 people were taken to hospitals with injuries over just 24 hours. Back in the United States, lawmakers grilled Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Homeland Security, during his confirmation hearing Wednesday. President Trump nominated Mullen to replace Kristi Noem, whom he fired earlier this month. Republican Homeland Security Committee Chair Rand Paul opened the hearing by confronting Mullen for calling him a, quote, freaking snake, and for siding with a neighbor who physically attacked the Republican senator, Rand Paul, back in 2017. Paul announced after the hearing he will vote no on the nomination. This is Democratic Senator Alyssa Slotkin questioning Mullen on the 2020 election.
Who won the 2020 election?
Ma'am, we know that President Joe Biden was sworn into office. He was the president for the last 4 years.
But I do believe won the election.
My job as Department of Homeland Security Secretary will be to make sure that we assure that the elections are fair and people can trust them.
In related news, ProPublica is reporting that DHS is demanding access to the Federal Parent Locator Service. It's a database holding the name, address, social security number, employer, and salary of every employed person in the U.S., plus sensitive information on children and domestic violence victims. The service is used by the government to find people who owe child support. Federal law explicitly bars DHS from using the database, but the Department of Health and Human Services is actively considering the request. CBS News is reporting the FBI and IRS are forming a joint initiative to investigate nonprofit organizations over suspected possible links to domestic terrorism. This comes after Attorney General Pam Bondi issued a memo last year ordering law enforcement agencies and federal prosecutors to compile a list of potential domestic terrorism organizations that promote, quote, extreme viewpoints on immigration, radical gender ideology, and anti-American sentiment, unquote. Democrats on the House Oversight Committee on Wednesday walked out of a closed-door briefing with Attorney General Pam Bondi and her deputy Todd Blanche on the Justice Department's handling of the Epstein files. According to Democrats, Bondi repeatedly declined to say whether she would comply with a subpoena requiring her to appear for a sworn deposition on April 14th. The briefing came one day after Oversight Committee Chair James Comer subpoenaed Bondi to testify before the committee. After the briefing, Bondi was asked by reporters if she would comply with a subpoena, to which she simply replied, "I will follow the law." Democratic Congressmember Summer Lee later asked Comer if he would compel Bondi to attend the April deposition, holding her in contempt if she refuses. Comer told Lee she was, quote, bitching. This is Congressmember Summer Lee, who's introduced articles of impeachment against Bondi.
AG Bondi has been obstructing justice. She has perjured herself multiple times, and she has been withholding critical documents that would inform this investigation into a pedophile, into corruption, possibly quite deeper, because we do not know who was all involved. Today, what their attempt was to push this under the rug, do something off the record that they would not have to be accountable for.
And a New York Times investigation has found Cesar Chavez, the late co-founder of the United Farm Workers, abused, molested, and raped multiple women and girls over the course of decades. Ana Murguia and Deborah Rojas say that Chavez sexually abused them for years when they were girls in the 1970s. Murguia and Chavez said Chavez assaulted her when she was 13 years old. Chavez reportedly raped Rojas when she was 15 years old in a motel room in 1975. Dolores Huerta, who co-founded the United Farm Workers with Cesar Chavez, told the New York Times he coerced her into sex on one occasion and raped her in 1966, resulting in two separate pregnancies she concealed by wearing baggy clothes. Both of Dolores Huerta's children were quietly raised by other families. In a statement, Huerta said, quote, "I carried this secret for as long as I did because building the movement and securing farm worker rights was my life's work. I'm telling my story because the New York Times has indicated I was not the only one. There were others. Women are coming forward sharing that they were sexually abused and assaulted by Cesar when they were girls and teenagers," Dolores Huerta said. United Farm Workers announced it'll not participate in any Cesar Chavez Day events this month, while the Cesar Chavez Foundation said, quote, "To the survivors, we believe you. We honor your courage, and we're very sorry for the harm you have carried in the shadows for so long," unquote. Both organizations have established confidential channels for those who wish to report harm. Local officials in California have called for renaming schools, parks, plazas, and streets bearing Cesar Chavez's name. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs announced the state would not recognize Cesar Chavez Day on March 31st, his birthday. Annual parades in Tucson, Arizona, and San Francisco, California, were also canceled, along with marches in San Antonio and Laredo, Texas. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. In a major escalation in the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, Israel bombed Iran's South Pars gas field, the largest known natural gas reserve in the world. Iran responded by attacking key energy infrastructure in Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and the United Arab Emirates. Iran launched two attacks in Qatar on Ras Laffan, the largest liquefied natural gas production facility in the world.
Israel's attack on South Pars comes days after Israel assassinated three more top Iranian figures: Iran's security chief, Ali Larijani, Iran's intelligence chief, Ismail Khatib, and the head of the besieged military, Golan Reza Soleimani. In the latest sign, the war on Iran could be just beginning. Reuters is reporting President Trump's considering deploying thousands of more U.S. troops to the Middle East. The Pentagon's also asked for $200 billion from Congress. We're joined now by Vali Nasser, an Iranian-American professor of international affairs and Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, SAIS. He's the author of Iran's Grand Strategy, A Political History. His recent piece for the Financial Times is headlined, "Iran is Playing a Long Game." He's joining us from Washington, D.C. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor. If you can start off by saying exactly what you mean, I think something that people in the United States hear very little of. What is Iran's long game? Tell us about who you believe the leadership is right now in Iran and what they are doing.
Iran is following a strategy that was conceived after the June war, the 12-day war they had with Israel. And it's being implemented systematically by commanders, decision makers in government and in the military. It's not dependent on one decision maker, as we saw that Israel killed Iran's supreme leader, and yet Iran was immediately able to retaliate and engage in the war. Iran has established a way of governing and fighting, which is called mosaic military strategy, mosaic government management, which is not dependent on one person. And it understood that it's going against much more powerful militaries, Israel and the United States, and it's not going to fight their war. It's going to fight the war that it wants. It's willing to absorb the hits that it's getting from Israel and the United States, and it thinks the longer that the war goes on, the less Israel and the United States would be able to defend against Iranian missiles because they're going to run out of interceptors. They had calculated the war would be quick. They have plenty of offensive bombs, but they don't have sufficient defenses. And we're seeing that more and more of Iran's deadly missiles are landing in Israel. They're landing in the Gulf. And also Iran decided to wage a longer war on global energy and the global markets using drones, mines, low-level ammunition, not necessarily ballistic missiles, to attack the Gulf economies across their energy fields as well as trade. And it calculated that the longer that this war goes, the less prepared the United States is for the consequences. President Trump calculated on a short war. He said he was surprised Iran attacked the Arab countries. He was not prepared to be 3 weeks into the war and perhaps much longer. The longer this war goes on, the more Iran is building leverage and the more the strategic calculations of Israel and the United States appear to be falling short.
Professor Nasser, if you could comment on the fact that the U.S. has deployed now or is in the process of deploying 2,500 Marines to the region, because, of course, you've mentioned Iran's war essentially on the global economy in a way to impact both America and Israel, who have much larger militaries. So in this asymmetric warfare, the Strait of Hormuz is a central question, its effective closure. But now with these 2,500 Marines in the region who will reportedly be tasked with working towards reopening the Strait, how does that change the equation for Iran, if at all?
Well, it's not very clear what 2,000 Marines can do, and they cannot arrive in the region immediately at any rate. It takes them 10 days to 2 weeks to be there. Perhaps the president was calculating that either there's a scenario in which that they could attack the northern shores of the Persian Gulf, the shore where Iran is sitting on top of the Straits of Hormuz, or capture some Iranian islands, either the Kharg Island where Iran exports most of its oil from and the U.S. has already attacked, or other islands. But I think after the United States and Israel tried to put pressure on Iran by attacking its gas field, and then we saw how Iran retaliated, this whole strategy may no longer be working. In fact, we saw President Trump in a posting on Truth Social back away from taking responsibility for Israel's attack on the Iranian gas field and saying Israel will not do it anymore. Will not do it anymore means that the U.S. is probably having second thoughts about very aggressive attacks on Iran in the Gulf as well, because it now understands that Iran can escalate in ways that the United States cannot defend against. You know, there's the way Iran attacked the Qatari gas field and refinery could also be visited on Saudi oil facilities on a much larger scale, UAE, at ports that send oil around the world. And so U.S. is finding itself in a situation where it's threatening Iran. It wants to threaten escalation and escalate, but it's not able to prevent Iran's counter-escalation and be able to account for the costs of that counter-escalation.
Professor Nasser, you did mention earlier that the Iranian regime is not dependent on one individual, so Khamenei's assassination has made very little difference. On the other hand, now there have been so many high-level assassinations, including Ali Larijani, top security official in Iran, the head of the paramilitary force, Basij force, among others. I mean, do you think that if this continues, Israeli and U.S. Targeted assassinations, whether that might make a difference? And also, where is Mujtaba Khamenei? What has the significance been of his ascension to power? And many people comment that he's scarcely been seen. There are rumors that he's, in fact, recovering in a hospital in Moscow because he was also injured in the attack that killed not only his father, but also his wife.
Yes, he's been severe. It is believed that he was injured, but I also think that the Iranians are trying to take precaution that he will not be assassinated as well, fully well knowing that he is the target. Of course, these assassinations do matter. There are important people who are taken out. For instance, the killing of Ali Larijani was not only killing a very significant node in Iran's power structure, but it was also killing somebody who was most likely to be a potential interlocutor for the U.S. if the point came for a negotiated off-ramp. But what we are seeing is that Iran's system is designed not to collapse easily. It doesn't mean that it will not collapse at some point. But the point of collapse clearly is far further down the road than U.S. and Israel anticipated. So maybe President Trump thought that the Iran war would be only 2-3 days. If you kill the supreme leader and a few other major commanders, that the system would collapse, or like Venezuela, it would come to its knees and come to terms with the U.S. And now we're three weeks into the war. The killings of Iranian leaders continues, but Iran is doesn't seem to either have changed course, nor is it actually looking like it's about to collapse. The attack yesterday on Qatar, the way in which Iran is escalating, suggests that there's a coherent decision making, at least at the military level in Iran. But one thing the Israeli decapitation of Iran's leader has achieved is that it actually has elevated a far more hardline and aggressive second-tier leadership to the top. In other words, Iran's version of restrainers, people who may have been more prudent, people who may have not reacted as aggressively, have been removed, and they are being replaced by people who are far more aggressive. And also that the Revolutionary Guards is now de facto has taken over all of Iran. And Mujtaba, in a way, was the choice of the Revolutionary Guard, is very close to the Revolutionary Guard. So the initial achievement of the decapitation has not been to force the regime to collapse, but is actually to radicalize the regime and produce a much worse version of the Islamic Republic than the one that was there before the war started.
On Wednesday, the director of national intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee. Now, ahead of the hearing, she submitted written testimony that asserted last year's U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iran had, quote, obliterated Iran's nuclear enrichment program, and that Iran had made, quote, no efforts to rebuild it. But during her opening remarks, Gabbard skipped over those sections. She was questioned by Democratic Senator George of Georgia, John Ossoff.
Was it the assessment of the intelligence community that there was a, quote, imminent nuclear threat posed by the Iranian regime, yes or no?
Senator, the only person who can determine what is and is not an imminent threat is the president.
False. This is the worldwide.
False, said Senator Ossoff, that it's not just President Trump, but she's supposed to be making recommendations. So, Professor Nasser, you were an advisor to the State Department during the Obama presidency, there while the President Obama worked out that nuclear deal with Iran that President Trump pulled out of. Talk about the significance of this and the lesson the rest of the world learned, from Pakistan to India, to whether you should engage in agreements with the United States around nuclear weapons.
I think the whole saga around the Iran nuclear deal has sapped the world of trust in dealing with the United States, and particularly with dealing with President Trump. I mean, the United States entered into a deal that it signed, and the other party implemented fully what was agreed to. And then yet it decided that it didn't like the deal. And not only it came out of it, but it actually punished the other side, punished Iran with maximum pressure sanctions, largely for actually having abided by the deal, and then demanded that it wanted a different deal, it wanted a new deal. So that raises questions about whether you could trust making a deal with the United States. And then fast forward to the fact that President Trump engaged twice with Iran in nuclear negotiations, and then in the middle of negotiations allowed Israel to start a war with Iran, in a way using negotiations as subterfuge for actually going to war. And the way that the war has been waged on Iran, the way that there's been decapitation of leadership in Iran, the way that the United States and Israel have made regime change the objective of war, combined with what's happened in Venezuela and what's happening in Cuba, I think will give a lot of countries around the world great incentive to actually go nuclear. Because they need the ultimate deterrence. The United States has taken upon itself to sign deals, shred deals, enter into negotiations, upend them by military attacks, and then dictate what leader it wants in what country. And this actually has sent a shockwave through the world. And of course, one can always say, okay, Iran is a regime that's been antagonistic to the U.S., and you can characterize it as a rogue regime, try to justify things. Whereas some European leader, German chancellor, has said that international law doesn't apply to Iran. But the rules that are being established around Iran, starting with abandoning the nuclear deal to the military attack today, will ultimately become, are being seen around the world as the new rules that govern the world. So the Iran rules are becoming world rules. And that, if that's the case, if we're entering a rule of the jungle, and or the rule that the United States will decide when to go to war and who can lead whatever country, then countries are going to try to find ways to defend against that. Some will enter into military pacts. Some will go under China and Russia's umbrella. But a lot of them will take now going back to having nuclear weapons very, very seriously.
Professor Nasser, I want to go back to a point you made earlier, namely that the regime within the regime, the people who have been appointed are more radical than the people that they replaced. You know, some people have commented that it took the U.S. 20 years to go from one Taliban government to another Taliban government, which indeed is far more radical than the one that came to power in 1996 in Afghanistan, and that it's taken 8 days to go from one Khamenei to another Khamenei in Iran. So if you could, first of all, comment on that. And also, what do we know about the effects of that, and indeed of the war, on people inside Iran?
The supreme leader that was killed, the older Khamenei, was obviously viewed in the West as a radical, as anti-American, as antagonistic to the U.S., and all of that is true. But at the same time, he was much more cautious than his son and the generation that is coming up. He, for instance, did not allow over 20 years for Iran to build nuclear weapons. In fact, he issued a fatwa against it, which was to shut down the conversation inside Iran about it. He would not allow the Revolutionary Guards to build missiles beyond 2,000 kilometers to reach deep into Europe. Every time the United States attacked Iran in a major way, starting by the killing of General Soleimani in 2020 to bombing Iran's nuclear sites, he chose to react symbolically and not to draw blood. And he got some criticism about that. The generation that is coming up believes that the only way in which Iran could establish deterrence against the United States is to be far more aggressive than the older Khamenei was willing to go. And the counterattack against Qatar for Israel's attack on Iran's gas fields is indicative of the new attitude in Tehran. In others, we won't react symbolically, but we will attack much more viciously than we were attacked. And now domestically, for now, I think the Iranian people are caught between a stone and a hard place. They've been traumatized first with the June war, then they're traumatized by the massive protests and the very bloody crackdown that killed thousands of Iranians in January. They had barely, taken stock of that that tragedy in January, that they are in the middle of a war. At the beginning, the war was marketed to them by United States and Israel, that it would be a war of liberation, that there would be only precision bombing against regime targets. But